you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome back to Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I am your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me is our pal and my fellow network all-star, Chris Franklin. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Hey, Rob. It's great to be back. I love what you've redone with the revamped Treasury Cast headquarters here. It's great. You know, it's like when they redesigned the Hall of Justice for the Superpowers cartoon, you know?
So it's... Yes, it is exactly like that. I'm so excited. I mean, you are our most frequent guest on the show. Of course, we did our annual Christmas episodes, and you've been on other episodes. Like I said, you've clocked more appearances on Treasury Cast than anyone other than me. And this book that we're here to talk about, the facsimile edition of The Untold Legend of the Batman, which came out on January 29th, 2025. I knew I wanted to have you on to talk about this. I originally had no plans to cover this, because even though it was, quote-unquote, DC's first, quote-unquote, new Treasury in decades, if you don't include, like, the Alex Ross, Paul Dini books, this was, like, the first – it was an exciting thing, but I figured it was a one-off, right? I just thought, well, for some reason they're doing this one. They're not going to do it again. Well, now, as I mentioned in the feedback section of the last episode – we now know they're doing JLA 200. And yes. I also happen to know that there is potentially, I'll put that asterisk there, another one coming down the pike. So this is clearly something DC is now doing, where they are taking some of their greatest comics and putting them in a Treasury format when they have never been in a Treasury format before. So that all of a sudden I said, well, now I really do want to cover this, because it's not a one-off. It's the first of hopefully a long list of many great comics. And so, of course, I wanted to have you on to talk about Batman. Did you have this miniseries when it originally came out in 1980?
No, I will tell you this. I saw the ads in the comics that haunted me. You know, the image of Batman on the rooftop. The image of Thomas Wayne as the first Batman. I didn't know anything about that, of course. I was like five or so. I wanted to find this miniseries. I could never find it. 2 years later, in 1982, Tor released a small black and white paperback, like, you know, paperback Harlequin novel, movie paperback size book, that reprinted all three miniseries in that strange, you know, cut up format that they would do to take a comic and do that. So I read it that way. So I read it the exact opposite way of the Treasury format.
Right. You read it the smallest way possible. Yeah.
Right, yeah, except for maybe a Superpowers type comic, you know, the little mini pack-ins. But yeah, that was how I read it, and it quickly became my Batman Bible. You know, okay. it was my, and I would try to impress my family with the factoids I learned. Did you know that Bruce Wayne was the first Robin? Did you know that Thomas Wayne was the first Batman?
I'm sure they love that. Did you drop any of those nuggets on Cindy when you were recording?
That's how I landed her. You know, I mean, I told her, I said, did you know that Alfred found out the secret identities of Batman and Robin because Robin brought him up through the Batcave because Bruce had been shot and he needed Alfred's help? You know, it's like,
as we all know, she's a very special woman. So right. It's great that that worked out for you. So I'm glad you said that you never saw it, because I didn't either. Mm. Right. And this is like a Batman miniseries drawn by Jim Aparo. Right. This is catnip for both of us. And I never saw this either. So it seems improbable that it had like limited distribution. It was a Batman miniseries, for Pete's sakes. I mean, Batman, but I never saw it either because Lord knows I would have bought this when it came out at the time. So I don't feel so bad now that you didn't see it either. So maybe it just, maybe because it was a miniseries or something, but that's so strange that like, you would just think this would have been racked at 7-Eleven, no problem. And yet I never saw it.
Yeah, I think this was the first comic miniseries that was intended to be a miniseries because the World of Krypton had come out like a year or two before when the Superman movie came out. But that had been intended for Showcase, and Showcase got canceled. And so they then.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. So the Paul Kupperberg, I think Howard Chaykin, Murphy Anderson, World of Krypton miniseries was not intended to be a miniseries. It was supposed to be three issues of Showcase. But this was created to be a miniseries. So this was the first intentional comic book miniseries, I think, from anybody, if you don't count comics that were canceled, like, you know, Man Bat after two issues or something like that.
Doesn't count.
Yeah, that doesn't count, which Siskoid and I just talked about in the on the FW team up. But it must have been hard to find. But, you know, it's weird that this comic has just keeps coming up in weird formats, even especially since the original is hard to find, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was, you probably are, but kind of going back to our Power Records show in the late, I guess, 1989, late 80s, there was a audio version of this released with a set of tapes that had the comics, and the audio is, I haven't tried to listen to it in probably like 30 years, and I know it's probably on YouTube somewhere. I wasn't a big fan of it. I thought it was quite a letdown from the Power Records days. I think Michael Bailey's a fan, so he's probably yelling at me right now. I can't say it was great. But the comics were like not regular comic size. They were like about like what, 3/4 of that size maybe. And then there was a version that was, you could get through Ralston Perina's Batman serial, which I think was the same comics as the audio version, maybe. I don't know that 100% for sure. And, you know, that was the famous Batman serial that the first version came with, a bank, a Michael Keaton plastic Batman bus bank that I still have in cellophane.
Of course you do.
I've got like almost 40-year-old serial in there, you know, so
break your teeth on it at this point.
Probably, but it's had a weird journey, and you know, it's never been collected in like a true trade paperback because it's not quite long enough, so they've put it in like the Tales of the Batman Len Wein, they put it in the Legend of the Dark Knight Jim Aparo volume 3 volume, but it's like, so it was nice to finally get it in kind of a trade paperback form, but it's a treasury, you know.
This thing has seen so many different formats. It is kind of ridiculous. It really is. And, you know, I have to say, just a couple of weeks ago, I made an appearance on Shag's Empire to Jedi show. And I talked about how I don't like, because by the way, I should mention, there'll be pages of this in the, you know what? As I'm recording, I don't know if I'm going to do a gallery. Anyway, to see how lazy I feel about doing a gallery or not on this, because everyone knows what this looks like. But the cover to the Treasury is from number 2, where Batman is jumping into the Batmobile, and he's like, Robin, you know, what does he say? Someone has learned all the secrets of my past, Robin, and he's using them to destroy me. Beautifully drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name. And it's kind of funny that that's the cover they went with, as opposed to the first cover or the third cover, which are much more representative of the series as a whole and are kind of more postery images. But I was just complaining on Shag Show that modern comics do nothing but poster covers. And I kind of don't like that. I like that it was when comics had covers that were representative of the contents inside. And that's what this is. So I guess I shouldn't complain about it because this is the kind of thing I like, where it's a little more traditional as opposed to just a poster cover. I don't. Which cover would you have gone for of the three?
Well, I hate to ever say anything negative about Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name. Because it's beautifully drawn, like you said. But even as a kid, when I saw this cover, I felt like it kind of misrepresents what's going on because Robin looks like he's driving away angry. He's got
He's
his
got
teeth
teeth are
gritted.
gray.
Yeah. And Batman's like, is he leaping into the car trying to tell him as he's leaping? Like he's literally going, someone has learned all the secrets of my past, Robin, and he's using them to destroy me. You know what I mean? Like it's like as Robin's like, driving away, So it's like, did Batman fall off the back of the Batmobile and he's still saying that as he's tumbling across the cave floor? I don't know. It just always, because that's not what happens in the comic. I know,
No.
yeah, I know there's liberties with what happens, but no, I thought like the first issue with the Joker, Riddler, and Penguin, like, this is how we're going to learn all the secrets of Batman when they're opening this fictional book of the Untold Legend. Or, of course, what the tour went with was the cover for number three, which looks like it's something straight out of the DC Style Guide by Garcia Lopez.
It's that monochromatic background with him just kind of jumping down,
Right,
towards
from the
the
fire
camera and
escape.
stuff. From the
Yeah.
fire escape. Totally.
Yeah, I love that one. Yeah.
So this thing reprints the all three comics, the In the Beginning, which is the first issue by Len Wein, John Byrne and Jim Aparo, which is there's a combo we'll like never see again, right? John Byrne
Right.
inked by Jim Aparo. And then you've got book two with Friends Like These by Wein and Aparo, where he does both pencils and inks, and then The Man Behind the Mask by Wein and Aparo. And for anyone who hasn't read this, the setup is basically, first of all, I love that Batman, it opens up with Batman opening his mail. Like, that just makes me laugh of like Batman gets mail. This is great. And he sees inside there's a package for him. He opens it and is the shredded costume of his father, who was the quote unquote original Batman, and we can talk about that in a minute. Now, the costume should be in Batman's Batcave. He goes and he finds it in the glass case where it should be there. And instead, there is a note that says, "This is only the beginning, Batman. Before I'm done, I will destroy you." And then Batman actually complains of a headache, which foreshadowing everybody. And then we get into this flashback where we talk about that Batman, Bruce Wayne's father, wore this bat costume for a Halloween party, and he ended up sort of foiling crime, and that was the seeds that of course led to Batman becoming Batman. Where are you on this? Where are you on that as an origin? So I, to be honest, I've never liked. I always thought that was a pretty goofy, but I don't know. Where are you on this?
Well, it's interesting because like I said, this became my Batman Bible, so I literally took all this as gospel, because I really only knew the I don't, according to publishing dates, I guess I got the best of DC, the year's best comic stories that reprinted To Kill a Legend from Bat Detective 500, the Alan Brenner Dick Giordano story, which Ryan and I just covered on Batman Nightcast. I got that before this. So that's where I learned Batman's origin. I never knew before. Of course, I was only five, or six or something by the time that come out. So, maybe seven. But I only knew that Thomas and Martha Wayne were killed. That's why I became Batman. So this filled in all the blanks. Now, I will admit, nowadays, I kind of like it not being that Thomas Wayne was Batman.
It's
But
a little too
yeah.
George Lucas-y from the prequels. Like, oh, it's all one big thing. It's all
Yeah.
connected. Like,
It
okay.
rhymes. It's like, but it's like poetry. But yeah,
Yeah, exactly.
I within this though, I think this is a good hook. I like that, it's a great, like, this is like the greatest clip show episode of a TV show ever.
Yes, it is.
There's always some device, and it's usually very thin, of why the characters are remembering back to specific things. And a lot of times, it's like, how does that character even remember that they weren't there, or something? But this all makes sense as Batman, Robin, Alfred throughout the series, and Gordon and different people reminisce and everything. But it's funny because I feel like there's parts of this I like in the first issue. Like, I've always loved, and I know I'm skipping ahead, but I love how he catches up to Joe Chill. I think that's so poetic. But I'd rather not have him be a hired gun by Lou Moxon, who was, which is, it
That's
takes
fair.
away from the random street crime aspect of Batman's origin, And whenever they do all that conspiracy, like it was the Court of Owls or it was this or that and all that stuff, to me, that's just piling on just like this, or there's too many reasons why Batman picked up the bat motif. Like, it was the, in the Shaman story in the first Legend of the Dark Knight arc, it was because they healed him with this bat shaman mask and blah 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 and all that. So it's like that's just like going back to Thomas Wayne. It's just the he saw okay the he saw the bats when he fell into the bat cave. Frank Miller added to that. That's fine. The bat comes through the window, whether he crashes through or it's open, whatever. That's enough. We
That's
don't need
enough.
15.
Right. That's enough.
We don't need 15 different things. We don't need him playing with Kirk Langstrom up in a theater with a dead bat like they added in the Secret Origin story. It's like that's I enjoy all those stories. I'm not trying to be overly negative. I do, but I think
No. I gave you the runway because I do. I don't like any of that stuff. It's just ladling too much onto it. That's all. It kind of reminds me of back many, many decades ago. I got a hold of the original script to Batman Returns, the original first draft script, and we find out in the one with Robin in it. And Vicki Vale, the whole bit. And we find out in that script that the Penguin hired Jack Napier to kill Bruce Wayne's parents.
Oh
I'm
my
like,
gosh.
come on. I'm like, does every villain had to be involved? Like, what's the third one gonna be? The Riddler was involved as well? I mean, come on. You're just ladling way, way too much. And that to me, having Thomas Wayne dressed as a bat and then fight. Get in like fisticuffs with a criminal. I'm like, okay, we have really just oversauced this, so.
The worst one that I ever that just like actually made me angry was in Spider-Man 3 when you find out that the burglar didn't kill Uncle Ben, it was Sandman accidentally killing him. I'm like, really?
Come
I mean, you
on,
just like took Spider-Man's motivation away. It's like, hold on. But I do like at the party though, if you notice that John Burns sneaks in his angel costume or angel's costume. It's got a bird head mask, but that bodysuit, that's the angel's costume from X-Men. So I love that John Burns snuck an
Oh,
X-Men
I
reference.
did not notice that. Oh, that's funny. Oh, look at that. Good for you, John Byrne. That's great. And then there's the other bit where we find out that young Bruce Wayne became Robin first. He was Robin first. That was another bit that, like, I don't think I ever knew about. This is like the only time I ever read that happened.
It was from an old story that they, from the 50s, I believe that I didn't look up that reference, but yeah, it's was in an older story, but yeah, that blew my mind. And as a time at the at a, as a kid at the time as a kid, I liked that aspect, but now that's part I really like. Yeah, that really takes away from Dick being Robin, and I kind of like the whole. I know that's kind of a modern thing, but that he, even from Batman Forever, that his Robin costume is inspired by a circus outfit. And I like that, Robin's really supposed to be, and Dick says that later when he, in the second issue, he talks about Robin Hood was one of his heroes, but Robin was supposed to be based on Robin Hood. It didn't have anything to do with the bird. That's why he's got chainmail shorts and a tunic. It just people Batman Robin, so it just makes sense to them. So that it became a bird motif more along the way. But I like the aspect though that he trained with the detective Harvey Harris. And actually, Rob, this comes back to one of your old shows For All Mankind, because E. Nelson Bridwell could had to make sense of the fact that Wendy and Marvin were there at the Hall of Justice. So Wendy was the niece of Harvey Harris. So
Oh man. Again, we give Roy Thomas crap for doing that, but E. Nelson was a bigger offender of that stuff, of anybody that had the right, Smith. He's related to another Smith. It's like there's only 90 million Smiths in the world. Like, what are we doing, E. Nelson? So,
Well, speaking of E. Nelson, I will say this. We learned that Mrs. Chilton,
oh,
the maid of Uncle Philip, both of them were introduced in Batman number 208, which was an 80-page giant that had like the many women in Batman's lives with a new framing sequence with Mrs. Chilton, where we're introduced to her. And that's where she reveals that she was also the mother of Joe Chill
Of yeah,
and
of right.
written by E. Nelson Bridwell.
of course, of course. Yeah, it's all a big tapestry. I do love the full page where after Batman becomes Batman, he sees the bat come through the window and he's like, I'll become Batman. And then they're kind of like, all right, now let's just kind of do a shortcut to his whole career. So we have this full page illustration of Batman pasting the Joker and knocking Robin is standing behind him and knocking him over. And then in the we get this it's not a surprint, but we get like this sort of faded color holds of all the various villains that Batman has taken on over the years. We see Catwoman and Two-Face, Penguin, Riddler, Dr. Phosphorus, Signalman. And it always makes me wonder when I see this, when artists get this kind of thing in the script, I always wonder how much is the writer telling them who to draw, or is it just enjoy yourself, like draw who you want to draw. Now, obviously, anybody saying here's the page that's going to represent Batman's rogues gallery, well, you're drawing Riddler, you're drawing Penguin, you're drawing Two-Face, you're drawing Catwoman. But then in there again, you've got Clayface, Mr. Freeze, Poison Ivy, you've got the Spook, you've got Dr. Zinzin, so Andrew's excited there. You've got Signalman. I have to wonder if some of these are like a John Byrne special, right? Like John Byrne was just like, you know what? I really like the Mad Hatter, or I really like this other Clayface, so I'm throwing them into the like. Do these guys, or your favorite Gentleman Ghost? Like, is that just kind of let John Byrne can just be like, you know what? I'm just playing favorites. I always wonder about that stuff.
Me too, because I really wonder how the hell Mirror Man slipped in. I mean, Mirror
Yep.
Man was like a one-off Batman villain from the
Yeah.
50s. How did he get in there? He's over right above Mad Hatter.
Yep,
It's
yep,
like,
yep.
yeah, it's really strange. And Wayne might have mentioned like Calendar Man and Gentleman Ghost because he wrote them in recent stories. But yeah, it makes you wonder if John Byrne and Dr. Phosphorus, but it makes you wonder if no, that was Englehart coming back. Never mind, sorry. But it makes you wonder, yeah, because Tweedledee and Tweedledum, they hadn't been around for decades.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does always make me wonder who does what. But with Burns, obviously, he was a fanboy turned pro, so he
Yeah.
might, unlike Jim Aparo, who was obviously became steeped in Batman lore just through drawing it. But I think I don't think he was more of an older guy that was like, I'm an illustrator and I started working in comics
Yeah,
type thing,
he was an adult who had a life and just
right?
ended up in comics.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Yeah,
totally, totally.
yeah.
I do like the bit in the story where Batman reveals to Joe Chill who he is, and he takes the cowl off, and you're like, you have to know that while Batman is not going to kill Joe Chill, he's got to know, like he can't let Joe Chill live, right? He can't, you know what I mean? Like he's like he can't have this guy out there with that knowledge. So it's like, okay, it's kind of like, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. It's like that kind of thing. You're like that. By the way, that was me doing Chris ba Christian Bale as Batman. And then, of course, that's exactly what happens. And this is the thing I one turn in the story that I do love is that when Joe Chill reveals to all these crooks that he was the one who killed Batman's son, and they all murder him because they're like, you created Batman? Like, what a fun idea of like that the guy, that's why he dies, is because the other crooks get pissed off at him. That's just a great wah, wah, wah kind of end for Joe Chill.
Yeah, and that story was written by Bill Finger. So from
That's
Batman
great.
number 47, the origin of Batman, like the expanded one from the late Golden Age. So yeah, and I love that. I've always loved that, and I love that they adapted that aspect of this in the episode Chill of the Night for the Brave and the Bold, the animated
Oh,
Brave and
they
the Bold.
did, didn't they? That's right. Oh.
That's the one where the Spectre and the Phantom Stranger are basically betting to see if Batman will go all dark and kill Joe
What a
Chill.
show. What a show. Man, what a show. What do you think of Byrne with Aparo inks? It's an unusual look.
When I was in this book, I can see Byrne in this
Oh, some of the
size. And
faces
I
for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I've got the original issue number one now in regular comic format, the original printing. But when I was a kid, I could barely, and I was always good about like I knew an Irv Novik Batman from a Don Newton Batman. Even back then, I was, in on merchandise, I could pick out, oh, that's an Irv Novik Batman on this toy I just bought. But I couldn't really see Byrne. I just saw Jim Aparo. Oh, it's the guy that draws the Brave and the Bold, But at this size, I can see it. But Aparo's a pretty strong inker, though. So it's still very Aparo-y. And that's good because, Byrne doesn't come back for two and three. But I believe I read, I think on his website, that Byrne said he had a certain gap in his schedule to do this series in DC, whether it was Len Wein not getting the scripts in on time, or somebody, Paul Levitz or somebody at DC wasn't getting him the scripts when he needed them. And so
Huh.
that's how he only ended up doing the first issue, because he just didn't have the time anymore. He's like, look, I've got this window. And he was, I think, in between being like exclusive to Marvel for a little bit. He could play around and work for other companies, and they missed it. So that's why he just did the first issue. So,
Okay, I always wondered why that was. I had to figure it was a scheduling thing, but yeah,
yeah.
it's a solid look. Like when I say it's unusual, I don't mean that it's unusual to the eye. I just mean we just haven't ever saw it. We just never saw it again. Jim
No.
Aparo inked almost never inked anybody. It was just inked
No.
himself. So it's
Yeah.
just an unusual combination, and I like it. It makes for a really attractive package. And then, of course, as of the second issue, it's full of Aparo, which is, I've said a million times, my all-time favorite comic book artist, period. So no problem there. I love when Batman in the second issue goes to the dive bar to find information, and he just starts literally like beating the shit out of that one guy. It takes Robin to be like, Batman, what are you doing? He's like, oh yeah, sorry about that. Like I've said before, Aparo was one of those artists that when he draws somebody getting hit, it looks like it's a pile driver. It
Oh,
looks
yeah.
like that your face would just fall off if you weren't hit with the force that way he draws it. And like, you know that that guy, while Robin did step in, you know that that guy is laying on the floor with like most of his teeth missing, probably. And so like that. So.
Yeah, and this was back in the day before Batman just brutalized people left and right, so this was shocking, you know. Nowadays, Batman, you know, just that's his MO. I know it's kind of moving away from that, but for years he was like, that was his MO, you know, just beat the living hell out of people to the point they can't even talk, you know, let alone give you any information. So, yeah.
Now the second issue is basically in the first half devoted to the history of Robin, of him introducing Robin and getting Robin involved in the Batman universe. And you know, because it's set in the flashback, we get the Batmobile at the time, which is the giant bat head on the front with the big fin. Now I know we've talked about this, and I think I already know your answer, but I'm old and I forget these things, Chris. We've been recording together a long time. What is your favorite iteration of the Batmobile? Because this one's mine. The 40s one with the big bat head and the fin on the back. That to me is that is my favorite Batmobile. What is your favorite?
Well, that's a favorite of mine, but it's not my favorites. That one, this is the first time I think I remember ever seeing that one. My favorite comic Batmobiles are the 1950s Dick Sprang Batmobile, the next one after this, which
Okay.
has the big bubble dome and has the incredibly long body with the crime lab in the back and the huge fin. That's my favorite. And then the one that they're driving in the current set story here, the 1978 Dick Giordano design one, that's like the 78-80s Batmobile that went all the way through till Bray Fogle redesigned it. I always loved that one. And it became basically the basis for the Superpowers
Superpowers, right? I
Batmobile.
figured that's what it was, but
Yeah.
I just sort of forgot. So, okay.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see that. And then we get the history of Alfred. We learn how Alfred learned to become Batman. We get the secret history of Alfred, which is funny because like they do in like 4 pages, like what I think there was like an Alfred TV show, right? That ran like two whole
Right.
seasons or something. They're telling that story. And then we get another full page, kind of a similar from the first book, where it's a collage of the villains, where Batman gets out all of his photos. He's got these little Polaroids of all of his villains, and he's like, it could be. He's like, you're looking. He says, Alfred, you're looking for suspects. Take your pick. And he points, and there's Joker, and there's Killer Moth, and it's like the same thing I said a minute ago, where right, you like you see some of these, like Professor Milo is in the back, and you're like, Professor Milo, really? And you're like, that's got to be a Jim Aparo. He just likes Professor, but like nobody would choose to put Professor Milo in a top 10 or even top 20 Batman villains. But I think that, or Killer Moth. But I feel like that's just Aparo's favorite. Now, once again, Gentleman Ghost is in there, and it's like it's so weird. I don't think of him as a Batman villain.
Yeah, he's traditionally a Hawkman villain, but
Yeah.
Wayne had written him in two Batman comics in the last year or two, so that's why. And I do think Professor Milo, I've read that Len Wein said that was one of his favorite characters. He was in a couple of 1950 stories, and he brought him back in that Moon of the Wolf story that the Al Adams drew. in the, the 100-page giant era of Batman that they adapted to Batman the Animated Series as well. And then he brought him back again around this time. He had like taken over Arkham Asylum, so he was the big Professor Milo fan, which he didn't make it into BTAS. He made it into the animated series, probably based on the fact that Len Wein revived him at some point, so that's kind of cute. But yeah,
Okay.
like why is the getaway genius behind
Yeah.
Poison Ivy? Who's pulling for that guy,
It's like, how many appearances? He have like what? One appearance? Two appearances?
Yeah,
To that
maybe one
point?
or
Yeah.
two.
I love all
Yeah,
that stuff.
yeah.
I just, as you're an artist, I'm an artist. We've had moments where like we could insert things to just entertain ourselves, right? And
Yeah.
so I, when I see that, I'm like, that had to be Jim Aparo. Must have been like, who do I know? I got to put Joker up front. I got to put Two-Face. Who can I stick in the back? Oh, I know Professor Milo and the Getaway Genius. That'll just entertain me. Like, okay, great. This is very funny. And
Yeah.
we get brief origins of Joker and Two-Face in this issue.
Yeah, that's great. This is the first time I learned either of those origins and the fact that Joker wasn't just a guy in makeup. Probably based on watching Cesar Romero, I just assumed the Joker, wore clown makeup. I
Right.
didn't think he was permanently colored that
So then in between issues 2 and 3, we get a house ad, which is for the DC, the stamp of approval, talking about all of the new backup features that are going to run in the expanded comics. I always love this ad just because of the variety of it. You've got Airwave and of course Aquaman there, and Kongorilla and Scalp Hunter and Seraph, the undisputed king of the Super Friends backup, Seraph, OMAC, Enemy Ace and stuff. And look, I know, these are facsimile editions. So it's not surprising that they would do this because they're reprinting them exactly the way they are. But I do appreciate the fidelity of it. That is, because this ad is meaningless to anybody, right? Beyond a certain age, like who the hell are half these characters? These are all books that have long since been canceled. Like, you know what I mean? It has no parlance nowadays. But I love that they're like, no, we're going to reprint them exactly as they looked, except bigger. So I just, I love a DC house ad, as I know you do too.
Oh yeah, and I love this one in particular. And I like the, there was this one. There was a version where they'd show like the cover. Like I remember there was the Brave and the Bold issue with the Penguin and Black Canary, and I remember that issue because that's the one where they show Black Canary in her underwear. And I'm like, why do I like that? That's like, but so I was like five, but again, but
It's like
anyway,
Miss Tessmacher or the Superman movie. You're like,
yeah,
huh.
it's like, yeah, why do I like Batgirl? Why do I like Linda Carter and O'Hara? I don't understand. But anyway,
All right.
of course, they've got a stamp for the Huntress, which is the only reason anybody bought Wonder Woman at that point. So,
Ooh, shots fired.
yeah, just kidding. Not really,
Not really. Really.
but.
So then we get the third issue and we learn how Batman got the Batmobile. So we get that, origin. And then there's this great sequence where Batman consults all of his underworld like stoolies, which I love, right? I love that it's like Slugger and there's a guy named Poet, and then there's Queen Bess. I don't know any of these characters. I have to assume that these are from the comic. Like Len Wein wasn't making these up, that these are one-offs or something that showed up. That's such an old-timey thing that's just out of, again, like modern parlance of like the denizens of the Gotham underworld, but they're not crooks, but they're adjacent to the crooked world, and so Batman uses them as informants. That's something out of old-timey detective stories that we just don't get anymore.
Yeah, and I think Len Wein had been he'd really been trying to kind of build up Gotham, introduce characters like that. And I think he did use some of these characters in his run. I can't 100% for sure verify that, but I feel like he did. Without rereading my Len Wein volume of Tales of Batman, which I do frequently reread because that's a great run. But and I think he was trying to build up, this is like their actual areas of Gotham City, and not we make up one every time you turn around. He was like trying to like flesh the city out, and
Yeah.
I like that. I'm glad they did that. I love when comic creators do that. That's one reason why I loved James Robinson's Starman so well, because Opal City became like okay, it's in Turk County. This is this part of Opal City. This is that part of Opal City. So, here's these characters that'll interact with Jack Knight. And I like that. And I'm glad he brought him into this. And the Jack Edison guy that created the Batmobile, that was new to this too, apparently. That had
Oh,
never
really? Oh,
been.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And I looked up his appearances. And after this, he appeared in Blue Devil because he's a stuntman. So it makes sense, right? So I guess he created, and Shaq could probably answer this if he were to listen to it, but he created him a Blue Devil mobile at some point. So,
That's great.
but,
That's
and they
great.
kind of adapted the idea of this guy into an episode of Batman the Animated Series called The Mechanic, where, there's a specific guy that builds the Batmobiles and like the Penguin kidnaps him. His name's Earl Cooper, and he's an older African American guy, so it's not Jack Edison, but it's kind of the same concept. So,
That's cool. That's cool. And then we get to Commissioner Gordon, how he becomes a friend of Batman. And then we get, of course, the Batgirl origin. She takes on Killer Moth. And then we get to the end of it where Batman all of a sudden is down in the cave and he sees his father, quote unquote, dressed as he was in the Halloween costume, in that Batman costume. And that drives Batman a little bonkers, as you can imagine, because he's like, what am I? Are you a ghost? And then he attacks him. And then we see that that is actually Robin dressed up. And we learn that there was an explosion that basically gave Batman a traumatic head injury. And all of this stuff has been his own doing. And it's a little like, okay, like that's kind of serious, right? did Batman go on Justice League adventures with this traumatic head injury? Like, I mean, I know it's the easiest way out of the story, but it is a little like, wow, that's kind of serious. Like, Batman should get that checked out, but he's like, nah, I'm fine. And then the story ends with him just standing there in front of Gotham City. You're like, oh, it's all good. Back to crime fighting.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that checks out with modern psychology and that Robin's like, I was hoping this would snap you out of it. It's like, I don't think that's how you get over schizophrenia and whatever, it's
Probably not.
some dissociative disorder that you have. It's so it's it, yeah, you got to kind of hand wave. Yeah, it's because of comics. It's just like, anytime you get bonked in the head, you'll get amnesia,
Right.
and get bonked again, you'll get it all back.
It all back. Yeah.
It's that, and you won't have, like, unfortunately, the awful results of real concussions. Like we joked, like you used to say in the Aquaman trend, many times he got bonked in the head,
Yeah, Aquaman is always getting hit in the head with
you'd
pieces of
have,
wood. Yeah, totally.
yeah. So it's kind of like that, yeah. And it's like you think about it, Batman went to the original Batcave because he's right now he's headquarters is the one he built under the Wayne Foundation building. So we went back to Wayne Manor, the original Batcave, and set up like a walls that would crush him, like. It him and Robin have to leap out of it to he has to leap like push Robin out of it to save him, and it's like, what kind of fugue state was he in when he did all this? When he tore up the costume, left the note, put a bomb in the Batmobile,
Was he
so
doing
it's like, yeah,
cases
I'm with
too in
you.
the
It's
middle
like.
of all this? Like, was he, what happened if Ra's al Ghul attacked? It would have been a real problem.
Ooh. I'm surprised Grant Morrison didn't do something with this and say that it was some kind of post, some suggestion, hypnotic suggestion or something that had something to do with the whole Zur-En-Auth stuff and the Batman RIP storyline or something. It really, if you overthink it, it's like, yeah, like you said, it's like, is he teaming up with Superman and World's Finest like
Right.
this? Is
Yeah.
he is he
Braving the
is he
Bold
on
too
martyr
much?
duty
Yeah,
in
yeah.
the Yeah, is he like teaming up with Zatanna while he's like messed up like this? And he's like on the Justice League satellite with the transmatter device that'll take you to Earth 2, but he's out of his head. I mean, like,
All the other
what?
JLAs are like, does he seem off to you? They're like, oh, I don't know. Any more than usual. So, okay.
Right.
It's an incredibly goofy ending. But it's fine. Like, it's
Yeah.
fine. This thing is just meant to be what it was for you, which was a Bible, right? A Bible
Right.
of all the important moments in Batman's history. Here you go, slammed between three sets of covers. Okay, great. So then we get all the bonus features, which is the Secrets of the Batman, drawn by Joe Staton, which is an
Yeah.
odd, why Joe Staton? I mean, like Joe Staton, but like, he's not a Batman artist. So I'd love to know, how did he end up drawing this, these two pages,
Yeah.
three pages, excuse
Me
me.
too.
And then there's the DC feature page with an Answer Man section, and then there's the big cover gallery. Now, you said you have the first issue of this, right? The original comic. Does that have ads in it?
I didn't pull the original out, so
Okay.
I
Because
can't say
like
somebody that.
this thing has like the table of contents and it's on the inside cover. And I'm like, well, I wonder where that was in the original con like I understand all this bonus feature stuff at the end because the third issue is a little bit shorter, but I'm kind of, I mean, it must have had ads. They sold it at newsstands. They didn't sell comics without ads in them, but it's just kind of like, oh, I wondered where all this kind of bonus feature stuff fit in. And then they have two more ads for Treasury Edition, Superman versus Muhammad Ali, Superman versus Wonder Woman. And then on the back cover is the ad for the Superman Club featuring that poster, that gorgeous poster that like I never saw. I never got my hands on that thing with all the great characters on it and stuff. And I have to say, when I bought this, when it came out a year ago, I have a do you have a spot in your house that you like read? Is there like a reading, a dedicated sort of reading spot in your house?
Yeah, I kind of tend to I tend to sit on one end of the couch. It's kind of like, I don't know, that's just kind of like my end of the couch, and I read there normally. Yeah, because there's an old sewing table there and a
Okay.
lamp, so yeah.
Okay. Because we have a chair, we have a an IKEA chair that Kelly had when I met her, and she's always wanted to get rid of it because it's, I don't know, she just doesn't love it, and I love it. And I'm always like, no, we're not getting rid of it. So this thing has gone from place to place to place with us, and then now it's down with us in Florida. And we have it in front of our balcony, and it's got these big windows, so there's all this light coming in. So one morning, after I got this comic, and it was like a Saturday morning, and she and the dog were sleeping in, and I got up, and I was like, you know what? I have some time. Let me sit. Now's the time I'm going to sit and read this. And I read this thing, and I kid you not, reading this, which I had never seen, obviously had never been in a Treasury format before, it was the closest I have ever felt to what it was like getting the original Treasuries when I was a kid. It really, I felt it while I was reading it. And because I had like, I got like a beverage, you know, I sat
Yeah.
there and I read
Yoo-hoo.
this. Yeah. And I sat there and I read this thing and I was like, look, okay, I understand that all these facsimile editions are totally mainlining nostalgia. I get that. But you know what? I'm like, considering the world at the moment, like there are worse things, right? There are worse things to figure out how to like deal with the horrors of the modern world than digging back into an old comic that reminded you of a simpler time. And I was so grateful that DC was giving this to me again, as corny as that sounds. Because it was like, it's one thing to read the facsimiles that are, to this point, reprints of treasuries that have already existed, you know, and they've done a bunch of that. Superman versus Flash. Well, I don't need to go through them all. We've been talking about them. But this was new. Even though I had already read Untold Legend of Batman before, I had never read it as a treasury. And just to read it in a big size featuring one of my all time. Well, not one of my all-time favorite comic book artist. Like, I just was like, wow, this is pretty close to being back in like 1979. And that was such an amazing experience. And I just got to thank DC for doing it. And I'm so excited that they're going to keep doing these because I didn't think that was possible. I really didn't. You know, a lot of water under the bridge since I was since I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
But this managed to get me back to it. And I don't know. I will like just forever love this Untold Legends treasury because it gave me something I didn't think I could ever feel again, as corny as that sounds.
Yeah, I get it. This one did pretty much the same thing for me. It's like because it was such a beloved book for me to see it in that format and to reread it. I mean, to just I don't know, it was just it, and I've reread it, you know, in my tour book. I reread it in the, like I said, the Tales of Batman Len Wein that I've got, and that was great. I was glad I got to reread it in actual regular size comic format in that trade paperback. But to get it like this, it's kind of like that same nerve that, like, there's been a couple things that have come out as a toy guy, like I can't, I don't know what what it is, but McFarlane started doing those superpowers line, and they made that. They've done several vehicles and stuff, and they've all been done really well. But the one that really got me was they did the Supermobile, and Kenner had done the Supermobile, but they changed it. McFarlane did the Big Fist 1970s, Supermobile that was on the Garcia Lopez covers. It was on the Super Friends show that Corgi made a, little toy of. They did that Supermobile with the fists go back and forth. And I was so happy to have that damn thing. I mean, it made me just smile and kind of like this book. It just like literally, like, it's like, yeah, this is why I like this stuff. I mean, it's speaking to me. So yeah, I totally get that. And that's great. I'm glad you had that moment when you get those little glimpses, and it's like, yeah, I mean, that little nostalgia salve, there's nothing wrong with
Yeah.
that.
I mean, again, I've been loving these facsimile reprints. Because just as a pure practical level, I love that these books are available at a cheaper price for new fans who are not going to be inclined to go, buy it at an old comic book store or go on eBay and spend 30, 40, $50 to get it. And so I love that they're doing them. Now, of course, if DC continues these facsimile reprints, they are going to run out eventually. I mean, they still got ways to go, but there's a bunch of the original treasuries that they're never going to be able to reprint. Like they're never going to do the Rudolphs. I don't even know if I mean, Rudolph is like owned by somebody, which is weird, but like they're never going to do the Rudolphs. Like they're not going to do Welcome Back, Kotter. They don't own Tarzan anymore. So there's a bunch that they'll never get to. But there's a couple of Batmans left, and there's a couple of Supermans and stuff like that. But there is a finite number of how many of these there are left to do. So I'm glad that they are now saying, well, now let's dip back into our catalog and find some great material that can be done at this size. And knowing that I might feel that again, and knowing that the JLA 200 is coming is just like, oh my God, like just, oh my God. I can relax after that one because there's nothing left for me to, I don't want to say nothing left for me to get excited about. That's too grim. But like that list that I did for 13th Dimension a couple of years ago, where I listed 13 great DC comics that should be given the Treasury format, JLA 200 was on my list. That's my number one pick. So now that they've done it, I can just sort of chill and be like, well, whatever they do after this is just pure gravy because they already did my favorite. I can relax, So, but just knowing I might feel that again was just so special to me. So, thank you, DC. Thank you, reprint editors.
You know what I'm pulling for, and it has to do with the tour paperback again, because I had the Life Story of Superman paperback around the same time that is from Action 500, which, as you and I discussed this on a previous Treasure Cast, intended to be a treasury. So it only makes sense, DC. Make it happen. And there's
Guys,
another
come on.
Superman movie coming out next year. Perfect timing.
There is no good reason not to do it next year. Just none at all. They're not doing anything with Supergirl this year, which is kind of a head scratcher. You would think it would be natural, but yeah, if you're going to do Action 500. Come on. I mean, what are we doing here? So it's this Untold Legend, just a great book. I'm so happy it exists. And it's just, instead of being a one-off, it seems like it's the beginning of a new run of DC Treasuries. And that is not anything that when I started this show, I thought was ever remotely possible. Right. And now we're here. And now we're here. And it's just the greatest thing ever. So I'm finally glad I got around to doing it. And Chris, thank you so much for doing it with me. I couldn't imagine anybody more fun to talk to about this.
Well, thanks, Rob. I really appreciate it. Thank you for letting me talk about one of my favorite comics with one of my favorite people. It was great.
Thank you. Why don't you tell people what you're working on the network?
Well, you can catch me and Ryan Daly on Batman Nightcast. We're covering Batman and Robin Year One by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, and we're also covering other stories. And we're going to actually do some Batman from kind of a little bit after this era, so the later adventures of the Earth One Batman. So that'll be fun. Cindy and I have recently done another episode of Mr. and Mrs. Superman on the Justice Society Presents feed, and we've actually got another one in the can that will come out later this summer. I just want to spread those out a little bit. And I do have a project I have been working on. I keep teasing it. It just keeps getting pushed back further. But I do have a project that I'm working on that's kind of Batman related. As soon as I get it done, I will announce it and put it out there. But I think it's a labor of love, and I might be the only person that cares about it, but I think it's going to be
No,
fun. So.
no, that's objectively not true, Chris. You've told us what it is, and we all did handstands about this. So,
Yeah.
no, that's object. Just no, that's not true. People will
If I
love it
get
when
through
it comes
if I
out.
could get through the first one, I overdid the first one. You don't imagine that, me going overboard with
I
something.
can't.
So,
That's I don't know what you're
yeah.
talking about. Of course, now, of course, you got to get on it because eventually you're going to crash into House of Frankenstein, and that's going to take up all your time.
That's true. That's coming up fast. I've already got a mental list of what I might and what we might do this year. And that's going to be fun. Speaking of Gentleman Ghost, you got to put up with that guy for another 2 months. So there
Love
you
it.
go.
Love it. Great stuff. So, well, again, thank you so much, Chris. And thank you all for listening. Of course, I'm going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains, like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
The Outcasters starts a bold new direction by covering Avengers Under Siege with Earth's mightiest podcasters. Outcasters Under Siege, coming in 2026, only on the Right On Network.
And we're back with listener feedback, and these are the comments we've got on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, for the previous episode of Treasury Cast, where we talked about Smurfs. With my pal and fellow network all Smurf, Brett Young. First up is John Dredge, who simply says, Smurftastic. Thanks, John. Bucky749 says, didn't they add more Smurf girls later in the cartoon? Because I seem to remember a few. If anyone knows, let me know in the comments. I didn't watch the show enough to know any of that, Bucky. I'm not familiar with the Smurfs continuity. Jason Keane went all in and named Smurfs after every single member of the Fire and Water Network. And I am not going to go through the entire list because this email would simply take too long to read. But I will mention he names me Commentary Smurf, smurfing the best DVDs and Blue Smurf discs with his insightful memories of Smurfs of Trivia. Thank you, Jason. And then the one other one I'll mention is my guest, Chris Franklin, where he says, Chris's power record Smurf, where Smurf by Night left a Gargamel's noise impact on this Smurf at a young age. Thank you, Jason. You've been paying attention. Mark Baker Wright says, thanks for covering this issue. Even if the subject matter is less than Smurfy, it's good to have this perspective on the end of the Treasury era. Pronunciation note, Pee-wee of Johan and Pee-wee is pronounced Pee-wee. I was saying it as Pee-wit. I think I should have known that. I assume that this is some French language thing. Insert Hugo Poirot to point out that the Smurfs are, in fact, Belgian. There are too many clues. While I didn't have any of the Marvel Smurf comics back in the day, I did have a presumably later collection of Smurf comics bound under the name Romeo and Smurfette that I believe I got from a school book fair 1 year. It followed the same pattern described for these books, translated adventures brought over from Belgium, mostly one-pagers with the occasional longer story included. I don't recall that it featured much Gargamel, though. I assume Marvel made an effort to include Gargamel stories due to his inclusion in the Saturday morning cartoon. Until next time. Thanks, Mark. Professor Chuckaletta says, I was aging out of Saturday morning cartoons by this time. The Smurfs get long, and I never could quite understand their enormous popularity at the time. Thanks for the fun episode. Thank you, Chuck. Brian Chufo says, since Treasury Cast and MASH Cast came out at the same time, someone, I didn't watch enough to do this, could assign the MASH characters to different Smurfs. I'd Papa Smurf more Colonel Potter. Is Papa Smurf more Colonel Potter or Colonel Blake? Is Smurfette more Major Houlihan or Radar? I don't know about the last one, but I would say Papa Smurf is more Colonel Potter than Colonel Blake. But Colonel Blake, Brian. Ada Boznar says, well, I'll be Smurfed. You Smurfing guys went and gave us another Treasury Smurf. Okay, I'll stop with the Smurfcabulary now. The Smurfs really weren't my jam. The cartoon debuted on Saturday mornings when I was in the seventh grade or thereabouts, so I was too mature for it, although I recall that a few of the girls in my class liked watching it. And I recall the Smurf Monthly comic on the spinner racks back then and thinking, yeah, no. However, I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. You guys really squeezed quite a bit of entertaining content of what seems like a rather middling Treasury book. I especially like Brett's story about the amusement park and ensuing blue vomit incident. Oh, man, his poor mom. By the way, while the Treasury hasn't been scanned, I found pretty decent scans of the three regular monthly issues at several sites. I won't post links here because they are likely in violation of all kinds of copyright regulations. But if you're interested, feel free to shoot me an email. You know, I didn't really think about that, but knowing that the Treasury is just a collection of reprints from the comics – yeah, those are easy to find. I guess I was thinking maybe, I don't know, it was a couple of months ago, but like maybe the page sizes would have been different. I don't know. I probably should have put that together. Sometimes it can be kind of thick. Brett Young, of course, the guest from that episode, says we had one job, drag an hour out of Smurf talk. Mission Smurfing accomplished. I can't Smurf you enough for Smurfing me on the show, Rob. It was Smurfy. Go Smurf yourself something nice. Thanks, Brett. Smurf Kian says Smurftavic episode, Smurf and Smurf. I Smurf and enjoy the history segment and even the stories. Great to have Smurfcast back, no matter what the subject matter. P.S. My copy is CGC 9.8 on sale now for $799. A total steal. Rob McCarthy says, one, Hulk Smurfs crossover now. Two, like any Dungeons & Dragons player in the 80s, we had a Smurf adventure and Star Wars and Wizard of Oz. And I, of course, did Duck Savage, but that was not Universal. I don't know enough about Dungeons & Dragons to know that that was obvious, Rob, but thank you for pointing that out. Ange said, Dr. Ange says, enjoyed Smurfs way more than I should have, watched them all at the time. Found this whole thing fascinating, especially the old time standard song Pung titles. Nice Smurfy, you can get it. I would understand that reference even as a kid. He says, I always wondered what those hats were called. I want one. You can put it on your Christmas list, Ange. Who knows? Nate the Great says, liked the Smurfs, especially the ColecoVision video game where you rescued Smurfette. You know, I really miss Saturday morning cartoons. I don't think I knew there was a video game. It only makes sense. But yeah, Nate, agree. I do miss Saturday morning cartoons. Chris Franklin from this very episode says, fun discussion, guys. I was big into Smurfs. My mom managed a Hallmark store, and they carried the Smurf figurines even before the Hanna-Barbera series hit. Once it did, the store was Smurf headquarters, and I had a direct connection. I still have most of my figurines. Wow. And we put out the seasonal ones at appropriate holidays. I even had nice stuffed figures of Johan and Pee-wee. But unfortunately, most of my Smurf merch bit the dust on my dad's basement, flooded a few years back. What is it with Smurfs and flooding? among those lost items, I believe, were the mini Smurf comics. They were the size of the Superpowers mask pack-in comics. I can't recall exactly how I got them or how they'd be distributed, but I think some of the stories were the same as the regular size Marvel comic with this Treasury was made from. And no, unfortunately, I never had this Treasury. Brett's story about yakking blue ice cream hit home big. Kings Island Amusement Park near Cincinnati, Ohio, used to have a Hanna-Barbera kids land. Their famous treat was their blue ice cream. I think initially it was called Huckleberry Hound ice cream. Since the Smurfs are popularized by HB here in the U.S., they kind of took over the park in the 80s. The HB boat ride that had Scooby-Doo, the Flintstones, etc. became a Smurf ride, for instance. And the blue ice cream became Smurf ice cream. HB eventually left Kings Island, but blue ice cream remained, and it's still there. And because it is so popular in Ohio and northern and central Kentucky, there are ice cream parlors, fast food joints that still carry it. And most people still call it Smurf ice cream. Oh, and I never forgive myself if I didn't mention that the Smurfs had the greatest licensed breakfast cereal ever, Smurf Berry Crunch. That berry flavor has never been properly replicated. I think it's because of the chemical that they use for it, Chris, has probably been outlawed. Although, oddly enough, last year's Keebler Strongberry version of their fudge strip cookies based on the 2025 Superman movie came very close. Boy, that was that last paragraph was like Mad Libs. Scott Arthur says, I think those smaller comics were intended as Halloween giveaways. They sound like comics Marvel published with superhero and Star Comics material in the late 80s, many under the title Marvel Comics Presents before that long-running series debuted. They were about 4x6 and 16 pages long. I know that they shipped in bulk, but I can't remember it. If they were intended to be given away by comic stores to encourage kids to come to the store in costume, or if they were sold to customers who wanted an alternative to candy for trick-or-treaters. Thank you so much for the info, Scott. And then finally, Mike Thomas says, great discussion. I was a little too old to get deeply into Smurfs when the cartoon premiered, but I remember it being a big deal and getting a lot of attention as a new show. I was still watching Super Friends, so I wasn't totally aged out of Saturday morning, and I did watch the Smurfs a few times. My uninformed headcanon was that the Smurf stories took place in modern times, but they were deep in the woods, so no one ever found them. Sort of like how the Legion of Doom headquarters was hidden so deep in the murky swamp that apparently even Superman couldn't find it. Get a no prize for that one, Mike. So thank you all for the comments. I really appreciate you listening to an hour of Smurf talk. I knew that even if Brett Young didn't have a lot to say about the Smurf treasury and how much was there to say, we would get an entertaining podcast out of it because Brett is just that good. And we did. It was a great discussion, as was this one on Untold Legend of the Batman with Chris Franklin. I had no intentions of really doing it when it was originally a one-off. And now I'm so grateful to know it is not a one-off. And so therefore we had to cover it on the show. So big thanks to Chris for trip hammering through the history of Batman with me. It was a great, great fun, as it always is. So again, thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the episodes of Treasury Cast on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can find me over on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts, where you can unlock various rewards, one of which is only checked on a show of your choice. All the people that used to support directly Treasury Cast have since moved on to other shows since Treasury Cast wrapped up. So we don't have any names to list. But nevertheless, I appreciate all the comments and all the listens. And I will mention, it doesn't really matter that much, but if you're so inclined, leave Treasury Cast a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. There haven't been a new review for the show in like 3 years, and it's just fun to read a new review once in a while. So if you're enjoying Treasure Cast being back, go and leave the show a 5-star review. I really appreciate it. It'd just be fun to read and nice to have a contemporary review. So that's going to do it for this episode. We will be back very soon for another special episode. I won't get into the details of what that one's going to cover, but trust me, I think it should be a lot of fun. And then, as I mentioned last episode, we will be back in either very late July or very early August to talk about the JLA 200 treasury, because there is no way I am not covering that on the show. I am quaking with excitement to get my hands on that book. It's at the time of this recording, it's exactly like 2 months away, and I just can't wait for that 2 months to pass so I can get my hands on that book. So anyway, thank you all for listening. Big thanks to my pal Chris Franklin, and we will see you soon. But until the next episode, go big or go home.
Thieves, look out. Thugs, beware. Killers, watch out. Wrongdoers, don't dare.
In the deepest dark of night, he waits for the danger. One man's holy flight, evil's only true avenger.
Solitary, dark-clad figure sits nestled in the shadows of a vast, sprawling cavern. Here, the most modern scientific equipment looms beside the most ancient tools of the murderous art, and countless unique trophies stand in mute testimony to the ability of one man. It is a cavern filled to bursting with the stuff of legend, the untold legend of the Batman!